ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It's always a pleasure and a challenge to be the session after the lunch. But we'll try to keep it very lively so that you can digest your food very quickly. I think we've all been alerted some time ago at the moment of the global food price crisis in a very rude way at the moment that discussion started to come up about food versus fuel. And I believe that a meeting like this cannot ignore these kind of signals that came from society, but at the same time need to make sure that we can start to focus, as has been illustrated very eloquently over the last 1.5 days, on solutions to these kind of discussions, rather than continue to dwell ourselves into the negativism of this contrast. But in order to be able to do that, I think it's important that we understand a little bit what are some of the primary drivers of the energy, bioenergy-based businesses and activities that are starting to develop around the world in a very expedient manner. And I've just listed a few of the key drivers on this first slide. We all know that high energy prices and the to-be-expected again, high energy prices in the future are one of the key drivers in combination in a number of different countries with energy security. Climate change has also been a very important driver at the moment that we start to look at bioenergy solutions in our society. And of course, in a number of different places, bioenergy based on agriculture production has also been seen as a very important mechanism to assist rural development and assist agriculture policies and diversification of agriculture policies around the world. In addition to that, there's a number of secondary drivers which I'm not going to go into in detail. One of the things which is important to remark, because during the discussions that went on over the last 1.5, 2 years, there was a lot of focus on biofuels. But one of the interesting figures I read recently in a study is that actually 97% of bioenergy at this point in time produced in the world is based on solid biomass rather than biofuels. And I think that's very, very important to remember, because that means that the world is already producing massive amounts at this point in time of bioenergy, which are based on different crop species and different tree species produced around the world. So biofuels actually represent only a very small portion of that. And I think that's very important to remember in this overall discussion. When we move on to the brutal reality that we were confronted with about a year ago, the increased food prices, I think when you go through the aftermath analysis of what happened at that point in time, it's very, very clear that there was not one primary underlying cause for what happened a year ago. It was really a complex of different factors that resulted in these higher food prices. Overall decrease of food reserves, some specific production issues that we were confronted with, decision of a number of countries to reduce food stocks in a strategic manner, restriction on exports, and we've heard a lot about trade and free trade over the last day and a half. Of course, increased fossil fuel prices, which have again had a major impact on fertilizer costs and overall agriculture input costs. And of course, on the demand side, an ever-increasing consumption of meat per capita, protein per capita, in growing economies like India, China, and other places in Southeast Asia. And then in addition to that, in a number of different countries, the clear political push for bioenergy applications. Now, the interesting thing that happened, and my company was one of the ones that experienced that, at the moment that commodity prices especially of food crops, went up quite dramatically. At that point in time, a lot of these feedstocks essentially competed themselves out of the market as a feedstock for biofuel production. So as a result of the increased prices of vegetable oils or sources of ethanol, that resulted in a dramatic decrease in profitability of a lot of the biofuel operations around the world. And that was a very rude wake-up call, I think particularly in the United States and also in Europe, that at the moment that you try to develop an industry like this, you have to do it on very, very sound economic grounds. And you should not do it too much on the basis of lots of additional subsidies on top of the subsidies that are already there. Biofuels, in some instances, definitely played a role. But increased food prices should not all be blamed on biofuels. And I think there's a number of very clear examples which illustrate that, and there's a number of issues that we need to touch upon. This morning, I very much liked the intervention of Mr. Velasco when he talked about the way that Brazil has developed a strategy of food and fuel production under the form of sugarcane, sugar and ethanol. And I think that particular example is one of the perfect examples of how this production can go hand in hand. Food production per capita in the world has never been higher than it is today. And I think we touched upon that as well. It's not necessarily about the total production of food, which is the issue. It's really food distribution, getting it to the different people that need it, which is one of the key problems. One of the things that I haven't heard mentioning a lot over the last few days is that there is still an enormous amount of food which is wasted in this world. And I haven't heard a lot of solutions and a lot of discussions on how we are going to prevent that. Wasted in luxury or wasted as a result of a lot of post-harvest issues that are being encountered in different countries. I'm a strong believer of the fact that the moment that you grow fuel crops in a responsible and integrated manner, that actually additional revenue streams from these activities can fuel additional food production with farmers. As long as we make sure that we move towards responsible integrated production systems, I believe that that will, over time, have a very positive effect overall on food production as well. And the other thing we shouldn't forget is that co-production of food, feed, fiber, and now fuel is not a new phenomenon. We've been doing that in this world for a very, very long time already. So the only difference is that we now have a number of additional solutions and a number of different options for farmers to create additional value for society. And then the last thing, which I think is very important as a remark, and we will come to that, I'm sure, in our discussions, it's extremely important that we recognize the particular differences between different countries and different regions at the moment that we tackle this particular discussion and we find solutions for this. Solutions that can work in sophisticated, at least that's what Europe believes it is, in sophisticated agriculture, are solutions that will probably not work in India. We will need other solutions there. And I think it's extremely important at the moment that we have our discussion in a minute, that we try to identify what is the mix of solutions that we can find, what are tailor-made solutions on a country-by-country and region-by-region basis, which we can start to identify and start to multiply in horizontal patterns rather than through paternalistic efforts as sometimes practiced by a number of organizations. And for me, it's going to be very important that we, at the moment we come up with solutions, that we ask ourselves a very, very honest question. That we ask ourselves the question, do we dare to look in the face of the farmers we are offering these solutions? And do we dare to ask them the question, if they are capable, after we brought the solution, capable and willing to pay part of our salary while bringing that solution? If the answer to that question is no, then at that point in time, we did not bring a solution. We added complexity to the life of that farmer. And I think it's very critical that we're honest with ourselves and that we're honest in asking these kind of questions. We can decide this afternoon to go again in an immense debate on food versus fuel. I would like to take a different approach, and I would like to, together with my fellow panelists, try to identify what are responsible ways of starting to produce and starting to come up with solutions where we produce food and fuel at the same time. And I think it's going to be critical at the moment that we do that we then try to measure our success by measuring it in terms of full sustainability. I would like to call it at the farmer's gate. And that's where I want to come back to what I said before. At the farmer's gate for me is sitting in the kitchen of that farmer and asking that question. Did I really bring something for your farm which added value? And then I think we really brought a solution to his farm. So let us focus this afternoon on solutions towards this, rather than delve into a lot of the issues that have been discussed already. Just a few teasers. I think it is important, and we heard it this morning, there is about 1 billion hectares of land which is out there, which we can analyze whether there is a potential to recuperate it for production of food and fuels and any other needs of society. And it's important that we analyze that. And this is an ongoing effort already in a number of different countries. We've stressed it already a number of times here. One of the solutions is definitely increased productivity. And that's where I believe it's very important that we introduce yield as a very, very important add-on sustainability criteria. Because at the end of the day, if solutions that we bring to the farmers don't create economic value for that farmer, then at that point in time we failed. One of the solutions, in my opinion, is start to move to farming systems where we start to integrate into mixed cropping patterns different products. I've seen myself a number of beautiful examples. In India, for instance, I visited a farm at a certain point in time, and that person was producing at the same time silkworms on his farms. He had a number of goats, he had a small Jatropha plantation, and he was producing food for his family. I know that is probably a luxury farm in India, but that person proved that it was possible on a small farm of 2 hectares to move towards a very, very sustainable integrated production system. Another thing which is, in my opinion, very, very critical, and we will come to that also in the discussion, is we should try to see and maximize as much as possible the value extraction from produce that is coming off an agriculture production. We have very, very much focused in the past our efforts in terms of research and in terms of development on recuperating value of one particular value stream. But it's becoming clear that any particular crop, you can recuperate different values from that. We can produce food, but whatever leftover biomass that we have can be recuperated under other forms as well. Of course, production of fuels and production of bioenergy from crops is not the only solution, and we will talk about other alternative solutions this afternoon. There is a number of people working on algae and so on. Those are other ways of making sure that we meet needs of society. So I think it's very clear already from this small list of suggested possible solutions, there is no one solution. And I would very strongly like to plead for the fact that it's critical for every single country in the world to identify their needs and to identify their solutions. And we should share different possible options, but we should respect the desire of that particular society, of that particular country, to come up with a mix of solutions that they need for their society. And I've seen too many times, and my friends of the European Commission are experts in that, that we export complex regulatory systems, that we export complex, what are also called solutions, into areas which don't add any value at all to these countries. I think these different countries, and I've traveled to a number of them, deserve a lot more respect than that. And I think that's very critical. With that, I've passed on to the panelists a number of teaser questions that I put down in preparation for this. So I suggest that we use these as guidance in our discussion later on. But what I first would like to do is ask the different panelists to introduce themselves very briefly and to talk for about 3 to 4 minutes to the topic so that we can get a first flavor of the diversity of opinions around the table. Thank you very much. We will start with the lady on the table. Mrs. Singh, very much welcome, and very much thank you for coming all the way from India to join us here. Can I ask you to briefly introduce yourself and then give us your insight in this very interesting and challenging topic?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Radha Singh, and I was the former Agriculture Secretary with the Government of India. And at the very outset, I would like to thank the organizers of the World Agriculture Forum for having given me this opportunity and this privilege of participating in this Congress. Over the past 1.5 days, several pertinent issues have been raised pertaining to food, agriculture, and energy security, underlying important aspects of interdependencies, of trade, of climate change, increased investments, research and development, enhanced productivity, infrastructure, education, including vulnerabilities of countries and their poor. Food, feed, fiber, and fuel. The world needs it all, and we obviously know it too. But will the finite resources, and this is, I think, the core issue, that will the finite resources of land and water and technology to help us overcome several of the biotic and abiotic stresses clearly provide the policy options and the decisions to be taken by each nation as to its needs and priorities, and at the aggregate level by the world community as to the sustainability of these choices in terms of its economics, environmental, and social costs. Countries have different varied geographical features, climatological conditions, land, water, and soil profiles. different capital and human resources? And would it be better off respecting these, but nonetheless building bridges and interdependencies wherever these are possible? So I think the VISTA really, and the whole discussion this afternoon, would have to take all these factors into consideration. On the back of crude oil prices, which were high, food prices also rose sharply. And that was, if you all recall, March 2007 to 2008 in many of the developing countries. This is still persisting, despite the fact that food prices have fallen. Many fingers were pointed to the use of edible crops like corn and to some extent sugarcane towards ethanol production and canola rapeseed oil for biodiesel production. That, we know, is not the whole story, as an overall mismatch between demand and supply factors were responsible, we believe, for such a situation. Nonetheless, ever since, debates have sharpened on the issue of food versus biofuel production and compelled countries to take stock of the new world food equation, that of energy, of biofuel, food security, climate change, biomass, agriculture, and pro-poor policy and programs. All this in one matrix, I think for the first time globally, has come together. While several countries, developing and developed, are planning expansion of ethanol and biodiesel production, including my own India, what we need to focus on is not so much a food versus fuel production scenario, but rather the commonalities among and between the two that will help us move towards an integrated approach of food and fuel and leverage investments into the agriculture, rural sector, which guarantees both farmers and the investors better return. So the debate over the past 1.5 days really was, how do we attract investment? And that's the way by which both biofuel production and the crop production can be tied together, integrated in a sense, in an approach where it becomes an attractive proposition for investors really to be investing in these areas, because the incomes are not only coming from crops, which are seen as very vulnerable, but from biofuel production. I think that is probably one of the win-win situations that we see happening. With countries having high population dependencies on agriculture, green energy solutions could help find new jobs and employment. I think this is the flavor of the season. The President of the United States has spoken times without number on how the whole green energy sector and efficiencies in management of energy can provide the much required jobs and employment that today we are seeking around the world. And now a little bit about India. It has the second largest arable land in the world, 163 million hectares out of its total geographical area of 329 million. The largest irrigated land network in the world, 63 million hectares, and 16 agroclimatic zones, all of which are partly temperate, partly tropics, semi-tropics, what have you, arid, semi-arid. Given India's high oil imports and the volatility of oil prices, its potential for biofuel production. The country has, at this point, and I am saying in quotes, at this point, it may change, it has opted for a non-competitive land use and commodity approach via the cultivation of Jatropha carcass and Karanj plantations, and used these plantation and its seeds for biodiesel production. The main tenets of this policy are utilization of cultivable wasteland for Jatropha and Karanj plantations. These are non-edible crops and not even liked by insects and pests and animals. There is serious R&D effort going on for the identification of elite germplasm, providing high yield and oil content. And number three, we do believe sincerely that these would help in providing the required rural employment and income so much necessary in India's rural areas. Therefore, and I think I am conscious that I'm taking a lot of time, the strategy really is towards a non-competitive, integrated food fuel approach, which includes an appropriate, transparent land allocation policy through leasing, contracting to corporates, individual joint partnerships, whatever formations we think will work on the ground. Number two, integrated models for involving multi-stakeholders to build scale. It's a country where the number of farmers are humongous, and most of them are having very small holdings. We cannot wish them away. So how do we aggregate and build scale and do what we wish to do on a scale where biofuel really becomes a reality and a substitute in some parts of rural India. Provide the effective backward and forward linkages. Three, second generation technology using waste mass, as the chairman has said in his presentation. Number four, strengthening extension services to address knowledge and management gaps. Five, use of joint product technology like sweet sorghum and saltwater algae. And a smart subsidy and incentive policy regime, which includes tax exemptions. Also, creation of a special body to facilitate farmers in carbon training. Now, I must confess to you that despite the fact that India's agriculture story, in fact, the growth story, is quite magical in the sense that before the downturn came, the country was growing almost at the rate of 9%. We still have a lot of work to do. I mean, there is an unconscionable number of people who are poor, who are malnutritioned, and who really need to be included into the growth process. And we do believe that despite all that the country has been able to do in terms of agriculture, graduated from a food deficit country into one of marginal surpluses, we have this huge mass of people that must be brought into the fold. And the way we believe this is possible is by incremental steps, one of which is the integration of food production with biofuel production. So it is a complementary approach, it is a non-competitive approach, but one that we believe is an entirely win-win situation. Thank you for your attention.
Professor.
Okay, I didn't explain. Okay, thank you very much, Chairman. I want to reintroduce myself. My name is Nuhu Hatibu. I come from East Africa. I'm leading a foundation called Kilimo Trust. Mr. Chairman, we must appreciate that a lot of issues that we want to raise for and against biofuels or this debate has been raised in the other context. And therefore, we are. I'm going to work on the assumption that the organizers will repeat those ideas that have been repeated many times to go into the communique of the and try to summarize some few things that I've heard other people say before, but they are valid in this situation. And my fellow panelist Sigurd actually say very, very good point, but I want to go to yesterday Osley's presentation, which showed that the first thing that we need to have in mind that we should not worry that we cannot do it. We can actually do food, fiber, and fuel with the resources that we have, land, water, and solar power. So that was a very good message for me. Now, what I want to add to that, which is exactly what Madam Sigurd just said, is that development, there is a model that was done by DFID, which is called livelihood model. And they have got these five livelihood assets, natural assets, financial asset, human asset, social capital, and so on and so on. And when you look at that model, it is very instructive to know that in development process, many of the people that want to get out of poverty now, the given asset that they have that they need to develop to other forms of assets so that they can actually develop is land, water, and solar power. They're getting those free of charge. Everybody have that coming to their rooftop. It doesn't matter what it is made of. And they've got some land they're standing over. Land can be made to them. But we are seeing those as the major resources for these people. And our biggest challenge to poverty reduction and development is how do we assist to turn these natural resources, land, water, and solar, into other aspects of development, human capital, financial capital, and social capital. How do we do that? Biofuels provide one way of doing that. Okay? So that is very important to start from that point. And I'm sure my colleague have just said that, but I just wanted to put it in a different perspective. So our biggest justification for supporting biofuels, as Madam C was saying, is to use these given natural resources and converting them into other assets, which then means that people are developed. Now, there is no argument about that. We've got countries in the Middle East that had only one asset, oil, and they are now super developed. They were clever enough to be able to convert that asset into other assets. Now they've built systems where they don't even depend on oil. Abu Dhabi has reached a point where the contribution of oil to their GDP has gone down to 19% because they've converted that resource called oil into other assets. They've got ports, whatever. One time they even want to control ports in the U.S. and the Congress did not like it. But that's the level they've reached. They were able to buy all the ports in the U.S. in converting their natural resource oil into other assets. We need to make sure that the poor people do that, and biofuels provided that one aspect. Another person I want to also refer to is also Joel from Brazil. He also showed that there is a model. It doesn't apply everywhere, but basically this is, I mean, the debate probably should end, and we should just need to act. The experiments will be done in Brazil, and the results have come in, it works. It is possible to do it, and you can integrate it. So basically, personally, I believe the need for the debate is finished. But certainly you need to adapt these models, you need to decide where it is useful, and so on and so on. The other very important, very soon I'll be sounding like a very big proponent of biofuels. I'm not, but I'm just giving some common sense points, is what Madam Singh have just said, is that biofuels, in the period there where we are still dependent on liquid fuels, has got another very big advantage for countries with excess land now, which, as Joel said this morning, you reach a point where the food market cannot absorb your capacity. And you cannot continue sitting on your capacity and say, you know, I am poor. but I cannot produce biofuels because people don't want it, and I must produce food. You need to use your resources to overcome your problems. So if you feel reach a point like Brazil reached where their sugar cane for sugar purposes consumption was not being absorbed in the world market, you move to something else, and we should do that. And what we are seeing is that in many countries now, there is a very good trade-off between producing biofuel and for import substitution, so that you can produce fuel where it is required. And then that will have a lot of other effects of farm activities, in processing, in transportation, and so on and so on. And that then leads to bigger development and income generation. So there is a lot of advantage there. And the third point that I already excused myself earlier, that I'm just picking good points that have been said by people before, is you as chairman, that we are already having biofuel in terms of solid fuel. So we are already using these natural resources of land and water in producing biofuels at the moment. So that is, again, not a debate anymore. Yesterday and today, and sometimes today, people were quoting crop production and livestock production for food as the biggest use of water. It is not true. The biggest use of water in the world is trees and forests. That is, if, as Kevin Igel said this morning, you count rain as the source of your water. You start measuring your water when the rain falls. So if you measure your water when the rain falls and you do a water partitioning, trees are the biggest users of water. And that is the biofuel that we have now. So the idea that using crops to produce biofuels will take a lot of water from the system is not true. I mean, we're already taking a lot of water into biofuel through trees. To the extent that South Africa now, they are charging you, they are sending you a water bill when you grow a forest because you are using a lot of water. So they actually send you a water bill for those trees drinking your water. Now, so after saying that, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to go I advocated a little bit biofuels. But again, another issue is to say now, when we come to the strategy that Madam Shah was proposing, and it was proposed earlier, of this integrated approach, and you said it, Mr. Chairman, yourself, of food, fiber, and fuel, we need to say, where should we focus our interventions? And again, this is why I want to quote my friend from Mikhail Olov from Russia, that we should recognize that productivity is the issue, covering the productivity gap, and our main problems are outside the agronomy. There are other major issues outside the agronomy that we need to deal with. Probably most of the agronomic problems have been solved, and we need to deal with the other major non-agronomic problems outside and be able to bring this to work, because we know that it can work. But the issue of land, I'll come back to what I mean, but the issue of land is critical. As I said, this is an asset. This is an asset that is available to poor people and to poor countries or to poor communities, that with multiple uses, including biofuels, then you create the opportunity for this capital asset to be converted into other assets that you need for development. But it is now the ownership, the rights, the transparency of that, that is going to the area of biggest work. I don't have any solution to that, Mr. Chairman. I'm just saying I see that to be the most important obstacle to utilizing this natural resource capital into development is the ownership, rights, transparency of utilization, and so on, of the land resources that we have. And that is probably where we need to do a lot of discussion. And what I want to say is the same for water. Apart from the few changes that we're going to see due to climate change, the amount of water you've got in the world is fixed. So you get your rain for this year, you use it wisely, you don't use it wisely, you'll get it next year again. So just like your salary, you get it and drink all of it on the first day of the month. As long as you are not fired, you'll get your salary next month again. So that kind of issue need to bear in mind, that the quantity of water that we're getting is almost fixed. So we need to now work out what is the best way of using it. And in terms of natural resources, I think there is, even in land, there's a lot of productivity gains that can be made. But in agriculture also, especially in crop production for consumption, there is a lot of work and a lot of gap that we can do for producing food, fiber, and fuel with less water. At the moment, you need more than 3,000 liters of water for your daily calorie needs. That's a lot of water. And if you eat beef, Every kilogram of beef that you consume, you have consumed 15 meters cubed of water. Now, when you see these figures, of course, they are very big. But the main reason that those figures are big is because of the inefficiency of the production system in terms of water use. We are, up to now, with all these advances, we are not able to measure carefully and accurately transpiration. So most of our production water uses are measured in terms of evapotranspiration. And the main problem is that always evaporation is bigger than transpiration, and evaporation is useless. So the main challenge is what we call vapor transfer. Can we, in the same system, get more transpiration and less evaporation, and basically use very little water to produce and cut down the amount of water that you need to produce your kilogram of beef from 15 maybe to 1 meter cubed? And it is possible. The science is there, and this is an area which I think requires a lot of work. Finally, Mr. Chairman, is to say, you've said it also, we need to look at the entire process in integrated fashion, as the previous panel said, and the waste of food and future waste of fuel and future, if you go to fuel and fibers, wastage is the biggest part of our production cost. So by cutting waste, we can create a lot of opportunity for transforming people in the rural areas who their main asset now is land, water, and solar power. And that is a critical factor. And that's why I even disagree with my colleagues from UK earlier that they've got a lot of water in the Northern Hemisphere, so we should focus. You've got only water, you don't have solar power, and they would like to suggest that we go into the tropics where we have got more solar power and things like that, and use that one to convert into energy. Okay, but this is the debate of where should they. I just wanted to say that we want to really focus on the topics. The final thing that I want to say, Mr. Chairman, is now a spanner into the works. Do biofuels have a future? Or are we just wasting our time here talking about them? Listen to President Obama today. He has announced very tough mileage standards in history for cars in the U.S. He's asking for 35 miles per gallon by 2016. And these are drivers, policy instruments, that are driving us towards more efficient engine and probably getting rid of the internal combustion engine. And I am seeing in a very short time, if we go with this kind of policy instruments and the work that is done in other sources of fuel, especially the battery, the only thing that stands between the internal combustion engine and it being thrown out of the window is the battery capacity. So if we crack that, do biofuels have a future? Because at the moment, 60% of our liquid fuel is used in cars. And if we pull them out from using liquid fuels, probably we don't have to worry about biofuels. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Lee, can I ask you to give your introduction?
Certainly. Thank you very much. I think that... The panelist to my left has kind of introduced me almost with his very last point, actually. Brief introduction, my name's Lee Broughton. I work for a family-run business here in St. Louis that owns and operates Alamo Rent-A-Car, Enterprise Rent-A-Car, and National Car Rental, which collectively makes us the largest rental car organization in the world. I'm part of a team that leads the efforts to better understand and address the impact of our company's business operations on the communities where we do business, and in the world as a whole. Two key components to that is the design and management of a strategic sustainability concept and to engage in risk and opportunities arising from it, ensuring that it helps drive competitive advantage and new business for us. One of those risks and opportunities brings us here. The overarching theme for our organization as the largest purchaser of vehicles in the world is sustaining and maintaining the viability of the passenger vehicle. But who would ever have thought that that might conflict with food prices? One of a number of surprises that we've all been greeted with recently, I dare say. So as part of a number of efforts underway in our company, the Taylor family donated $25 million to create the Enterprise Rent-A-Car Institute for Renewable Fuels, housed at the Danforth Plant Science Center, where top scientists are working on alternatives to finite fossil fuels by finding new ways to create fuel from renewable, reliable plant sources. Our NGO partner in this was carefully sought out. The Danforth Plant Science Center's mission is to improve the human condition through plant science by feeding the hungry and improving human health and preserving and renewing the environment. The man heading up this Enterprise Institute is Dr. Richard Sayer. He is working on processes for harvesting oil from algae and other such organisms that do not compete with food production. Our goal is to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and lessen the world's dependency on fossil fuels. Both the Danforth Centre and Enterprise Institute is acutely aware of food security surrounding alternative fuel, and we are working hard to ensure there are solutions, whether that be biomass extraction, cellulosic, or whatever. One such solution might very well be algae, as the chairman mentioned. The oil extracted has a high energy density. It can be harvested every year, every day of the year, and you do not directly compete, as I mentioned, with food production. 30% of the algae and 90% of the water used can be recycled to date. The other 70% of the processed algae can be fermented for methane to produce more than enough clean power to run the oil production process, returned to the soil as fertilizer or used animal feed. Algae is a tremendously robust organism that has a rapid growth rate. Apparently it doubles roughly every 6 to 12 hours. And I'm told that 100% of its biomass can be harvested. The bottom line is economics. How will we reduce a gallon of it from current prices that stand at around $35 a gallon to approximately $2 a gallon? We are a car rental car company first. However, we believe we have responsibility to sustain our profit, our people, and our planet. One of the ways we see this working out is by embracing alternative technology and research. Today, it would seem that there is significant mileage to be gained in biofuel production that does not compete with food production, and algae could become a significant part of that.
Thank you. I had promised you different solutions, so this is definitely another one. Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank also the WAF for inviting me to participate in this forum. My name is Bill Horan. I am a dirt farmer from Iowa, the next state up the road. We grow mostly corn and soybeans on our farm on a commercial basis. We also have a company that produces protein-based human pharmaceuticals. And in the last 3 years, we have developed an industrial development company that we've put together that has built four biodiesel plants in Iowa, 30 million gallon a year biodiesel plants. So I sort of operate on the lowest rung of the ladder here for the food and fuel debate. It is the center of my world because I grow food, medicine, and fuel. So I'm here representing an organization that I was invited to help start in Washington, D.C. about 4 years ago. 25 by 25, some of you have heard of it. Our goal is to provide for the United States 25% renewable energy by 2025. We believe that there is enough plant material that we can produce in this country to provide the food, feed, fiber, and fuel. And they're not mutually exclusive. We commissioned the University of Tennessee to put together an economic study, and that study has shown that we can generate hundreds of billions of new dollars of economic activity with renewable energy in this country alone. It, of course, improves national security if we lessen our dependence on imported foreign oil, and it will result in improved soil, water, and air quality. So it's a win-win-win situation, we believe. There are challenges, however. For instance, we have legacy stakeholders, petroleum industry, that has a little different agenda. We have ideologues who see good as the enemy of the perfect. We have to somehow pull together our technical and investment challenges to get to the finish line on renewables, make them a commercial viable commercial product. Biofuels provide a valuable near-term solution. There aren't many near-term solutions out there, but agriculture is certainly one of them. The EPA says that ag and forestry is responsible for about 7% of the total U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. But at the same time, we have the potential in agriculture to sequester 25% of the annual emissions. So there's a formula there that is a huge win and a near-term win. So in my part of the world, some of the things that we're interested in doing and doing are trying to figure out how does a farmer decide on his balance between energy crops, food crops. We believe that the marketplace ought to make those determinations. What we're starting to see in the Midwest, upper Midwest of the U.S., is that these ethanol and biodiesel plants that are very, very large, and they're very, very large because that's where you gain the most economic viability, that farmers close to these ethanol and biodiesel plants are tending to grow crops that feed those plants. Farmers that don't have one of those large refineries in their neighborhood tend to lean more toward food production crops. So we see a regionality being developed in this industry as it moves forward. Everyone's also concerned about what is the carbon footprint and how do we control our carbon footprint. Well, in the upper Midwest at least, these large refineries are built on mainline railroad lines. And of course, we can move product from a sparsely populated Midwest part of this country to the East and West Coast, where the customers are in the densely populated areas, by rail, which of course is the most efficient way we can do it. There's some by barge, but mostly by rail. And there's being developed as we speak several pipeline tests, which is the very best way to move these products in regard to a carbon footprint. There's been a lot of discussion here and other places about the food price spike that we saw in the last year. And there's been questions about, we didn't see it coming. How are we going to prevent this in the future? And who are the people that it impacts? Well, from where I sit, it looks to me like if we want to know about the next food price spike, all we have to do is watch crude oil prices, because there's a direct correlation. So if we think that there's going to be a crude oil price spike coming, that's going to be the best indicator that we have that there's also going to be a food price spike. So the issue that we have to deal with in agriculture is how do we mitigate those trends as they hit us?